All right, welcome to class today. Glad to see you here. First, because I know there are many people on the wait list and there will be people interested in this, sort of a status update on that. I was told to first find people that had already been accepted into majors that need the class and grant them CIS permissions, which I did. It takes 48 hours for those to be finished. And then I was told after that I could increase the enrollment by a moderate amount, probably about 10 students. And so that will happen probably Friday, maybe tomorrow, depends on how quickly some other things happen. And that is what I was told I could do, so that is what I will do. Also just FYI, we have about 18, I think it was 18 people, dropped the class before the add deadline last semester. We have had two so far this semester. I don't know if we will get to 18 or not. We will find out. Anyway, so that's some information about sort of enrollments and so forth. Before I dive into other things we're going to talk about, questions, comments, concerns, other things for me. Yes?
I know you talked about expanding the class size last class. Is that successful so far, or is that looking at the time?
I thought I just explained that, Did I not?
Yes.
Well, could somebody give me a summary? Because perhaps I didn't explain it clearly. Nope, apparently I didn't explain it clearly. On Friday, I expect to add 10 seats. It's the shortest version of that. Other questions? Yes?
Under the risk tab on this website,
That's actually, I was going to talk about that. So, there is a quiz available. This one actually won't count towards your grade. It's an opportunity for you to practice using the quiz site for the online quizzes. You notice it's entitled You and Your Habits. It was open on Monday. It closes on Wednesday. Normally they'll close Monday, but we don't have class Monday. Unlimited time. I started it. Hooray. All right, so what happens in this? You click a quiz, okay? I've already filled out one of these things. The idea is as soon as you type something, it will send it to the server so we always know everything you did. And how do you know it made it to the server? When I work on a question, as soon as I change something, it will turn this yellowish color to tell me, you've made an edit, we haven't sent to the server yet. And when I finish making it, it will turn green if it successfully communicated with the server. So if the background is green, then it has sent what you did to the server. If the background is white, you haven't made any edits this visit. If it is orange or yellow, then it means that we failed to talk to the server or haven't heard back from the server yet. And that's just how it is. Other questions about that? Another comment here about this, you'll notice that we have this comments field. So most of the quiz questions will be multiple choice, like this, and you'll be able to select. Some will be single select, some will be multiple select. And you never need to write comments. If you do write comments and you didn't get points, then we'll go and read your comments to see if we think that you misunderstood something. So the purpose of comments is primarily to provide information to us about how you did this problem. Also, we would appreciate it if you used any source. Note that all of our online quizzes will... I guess we don't have it listed for this one, but they will be open to any resource that existed before the quiz existed. So you're not allowed to talk to friends, you're not allowed to ask questions on forums and get answers, etc. But you are allowed to look at websites and arbitrary texts and anything that existed before the quiz opened. And so if you found any of those useful, we would appreciate it if you would tell us which ones they are. In part because it's good academic practice to tell us your sources. In part because we might discover some of those are really cool and be able to use them to make the course easier for everybody later. So that's a thing I would encourage you to use your comments for. And if you find something ambiguous about the question, then you're welcome to write it there, right? So I could say here, nothing. And then I could say, please do not talk to me. I don't like speech. Okay? I especially don't like it spelled like that. All right. Nope, I spelled it right the first time. I can't spell. All right. And also note that it's when I leave a text field that it turns green. So as you are typing, we don't send every character We could. We did it once at one point, but it just wasn't useful. Anyway, so we have all of that. This also means, incidentally, that I do technically have a log of all of the answers you've ever typed somewhere on a server. I do not routinely look at that, but if at some point you feel like, ah, oh, I had it right, and then I tried to change it and the time ran out on me at the last minute or something, tell me and I can go look and see that you indeed did say other things earlier and so forth. Any other questions about the quizzing site? All right, I encourage you all to try it out with this quiz, both because I'm interested in the answers and to see if there's any issues that we can fix. The first quiz won't contribute to your grade, but we would appreciate knowing the answers anyway because we like you, sort of, we hope. I guess there's a chance you'd say things that make us not like you, but I doubt that will happen. All right. Any other logistic-y kind of questions or other questions you have before we dive into our material for the day? Okay. The other thing I wanted to say, I met with RTAs yesterday and we finalized a portion about the grading. We determined that we would use these four topical categories for different activities: logic, proof, structures, and numbers. Here's a definition of them. This will make more sense as we progress. And that here is all of our letter grades. Again, this will make more sense as we progress. We may come back to it after we've done a little bit as well. But we now have posted this and have hooked it up to the progress site mostly and so forth. So this should be, as we start doing assignments and you start seeing grades, we'll come back and look at what this means again. But that has changed since our last meeting and I thought I ought to say so. All right. Our primary task today is to talk about real maths rather than the sort that you've learned thus far in your life. And to explain why those are different, let's start with this analogy. In your school English classes, what do you learn about? What are topics you learn in English class?
Grammar.
Grammar. Yeah.
How to write.
Okay, what do you mean by how to write? Like how to create letters?
How to write essays.
Okay.
Is spelling.
Spelling. Yeah, some of us learn that better than others. Yeah?
Reading about pricing.
All right, and we can keep going. What do English professionals do? If you get a degree in English and get a job in your field, what are you doing with your life? Yeah?
Teaching English.
So you're teaching. Is that all you're doing? Yeah?
Writing.
You're writing. Yeah?
Research.
Yep, okay. And?
Editing.
To what degree does the English you learned in school match what English professionals do? This is a question I think is worth thinking about any field. We teach stuff in fields that are useful to the field. Right? We expect somebody with a degree in English to understand grammar and essay structure and spelling and so forth. But we don't expect them to spend most of their time thinking about that. Even editors don't spend most of their time thinking about grammar. Right? They spend much more of their time thinking about did you use grammar and so forth in a way that will help convey the idea you wanted to get across. Right? It's this higher level understanding of which these are the building blocks. And if you just love spelling bees, I'm afraid you're just doomed because you can't do that as a career, right? And that is just the nature of almost every topic in school. So, what do you learn in your mathematics classes thus far? What are ideas that you've learned about?
Arithmetic.
Arithmetic. Yeah.
Calculus.
Geometry.
Algebra, geometry.
Okay, are these what mathematicians do? What do mathematicians do? That is essentially what we're going to talk about today. And part of the reason we're going to talk about it, we're not going to get all the way into it because I'm not trying to prepare you to be full mathematicians. But part of this course, we're going to try to bring you above these techniques These are tools. They're fairly low-level tools. They have rules about them and so on. In fact, pretty much all of these are things that a computer can do for you. Right? And there's some level in your math classes about knowing when to apply them. But we're going to try to bring you from that base level to a much higher level in this class, to the degree we can, to start thinking more about thinking like a mathematician. And so to begin, we're going to take this nice essay that Jeremy Kuhn wrote called The Six Habits of Highly Mathematical People. Hopefully many of you had a chance to see that. I read at least some of that article. Not bad. That'll change. But for now, we're still doing your reading. Huzzah! All right. I'm just going to go through those six habits. I'm going to look at one. We'll see first if you had questions about his discussion of it, and then we'll look a little bit beyond. So, let's start with definitions. His first item was discussing definitions. I have two quotes from his article here. Mathematicians obsess over the best and most useful meaning of every word they use. And the most common question a mathematician has when encountering a new topic is, what exactly do you mean by that word? Okay, there are a lot of other things he said. Before we dive into what I want to say about this, questions, thoughts, comments, observations you had about what Jeremy Kuhn had to say about discussing definitions. Okay, then let's discuss some definitions. I have here two things you might be asked fairly often in your computing career. How fast is your algorithm and is your code correct? Let's just see how we do about discussing definitions already. Turn to where you're sitting next to, pick some words in these claims, either claim, both claims, I don't care, and try to discuss what you think the word means with the rigor of a mathematician. Do that for a bit, then we'll come and talk about it. I like the word. All right. Did anybody think they thought, I have a good and fairly succinct definition of correct? Yes?
That's what you intended to do.
All right. I know we can get a lot of other definitions, but let's dive into something that often happens as we try to define terms. You've just added more words than we started with. Okay? Which means we need to know what all of those words mean. Let's pick a word in this new definition that we should define.
You.
You. All right? How should we define you in the does what you intend it to do? Yeah?
The programmer.
Ooh. This is an interesting question. Is the programmer the right you? Who's another you we could mean?
The client.
Who's another you we could mean?
Customer.
The customer. What's the difference between the customer and the client? Who up here? Let's assume those are the same or different. Who's yet another person we could think is the right you?
Boss. Yeah, manager.
Your manager. All right, let's just assume for a moment you discover that the programmer, the client, the customer, and the manager all intend different things. Whose version of what it's supposed to do should you use? And this brings part of the idea about discussing definitions. Knowing what the right definition is, trying to understand definitions, raises questions you probably didn't think about before you dive into definitions. The process of trying to define helps you understand the field. Even if you never settle on a final definition, you'll start to ask questions you wouldn't otherwise ask, right? If I just said, is your code correct? You probably, most of you probably never pause to think, well, according to my manager or according to the client, right? But it is a meaningful question to ask. And arguably, that question, according to the manager or the client, is at the heart of a lot of the larger news items, security breaches and privacy policies and so on that show up in the news today. What the manager wants is to make money. What the client wants is usually not to have the manager make money, right? Because there's a fundamental disconnect in desire. And that idea shows up in a lot of things you might not expect. Okay? So, we can keep going on this, but discussing definitions is really important. Let's take a word from this other one that isn't you. What's another word we should discuss the definition of? Yes?
Fast.
Oh. All right. Who can give me a nice, succinct definition for fast? Yes.
Quick.
Ooh. Random aside, I love the history of English. What is the meaning of quick versus fast? Yeah.
Like velocity versus how fast it accelerates.
So velocity versus acceleration, we might think of that in a physics context. Does anybody happen to know where the word quick came from, linguistically? Until 300 years ago, quick meant alive. And so you'd say things are quicker if they were more lively. Anyway, that's complete aside. And fast actually meant secure, like the fastness of your fortifications. Words have odd origins. Anyway, so we went fast, we went quick. What does this mean for an algorithm? How would we know if one algorithm is faster than another? Yeah. Okay. What do you mean by time whoa, I didn't spell right. What does time complexity mean? Yeah, so we have this formalism that you will either learn, have learned about or will learn about depending on what classes you're in right now. A big O notation. It is a mathematical formalism. It turns out that fast matters enough in computing. We stopped using English and started using math. Okay? And that is an important step. At some point, we give up on words because words are ambiguous. And we start using symbols. Okay? But even these symbols will give us weird behaviors. There's a famous task. There's a task called linear programming, which is a weird term. It basically means finding solutions to sets of linear inequalities that maximize a linear function. Not really important to understand what it is. And there are two major solutions to it. There's the simplex algorithm and the interior point algorithm. Okay? And the simplex algorithm is big O 2 to the n, and the interior point algorithm is big O n squared. Now, if you don't know big O notation, the important thing to know about big O notation is n is how big your problem is, and so this is saying if for bigger problems, how much does it grow? And so this is saying, you know, if I go from size 10 to size 11, this one doubles in complexity. If I go from size 10 to size 11, this one increases only by a factor of 10, a much smaller thing. N squared is much more efficient. Except, this only matters if you have problems that are literally hundreds of thousands large. Or very carefully constructed bad problems that are smaller. In almost all circumstances, the big O notation, the formal definition would say this is slow, and this is fast. But in practice, this one is slow, and this one is fast. because, oops, the real world is different than math. Okay? And you'll get to see some of these things as you progress. We're not going to go into this. I'm just pointing this out as a teaser, that even when we try to give good mathematical definitions, they still don't always work. And we still have to go back to the human definitions and reevaluate, are definitions good? Discussing definitions. Second item, producing examples and counterexamples. Again, a quote from Kuhn. When encountering a new existing definition, the first thing every mathematician does is write down examples and counterexamples to help them understand it better. So I have written up here two statements. Your job is to do what every mathematician does. Write down examples and counterexamples. What does that mean? It means I have written something down. Try to write down specific instances, what it would mean for that instance. And as you're doing that, you should try to think of examples where it would be true, and if possible, examples where it would be false. So spend a few minutes, child, you're saying, next two, see if you can come up with examples and counterexamples for both of these sentences. The first time I've asked for an example and I haven't shown you any, so there's some risk in what you say. It's all right. We like to be wrong often and admit it. Yes?
When x is higher than 10, then it's true.
All right, 10 times 10 is faster than 10 plus 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Do we agree with this?
Yeah.
Now, to know if it's actually true, we'd have to time it. And that is a surprisingly hard thing to do that you may get to as you take computer architecture. We'll go into a tiny bit of this. Anyway, timing code is surprisingly challenging. But presumably if you get big enough numbers, it will become true. How about a counterexample? Yes?
When x is 5 and y is 0.
Y times 0 is faster than... Is this the right way of writing the counterexample? I need to write 0 fives. Did I succeed in doing that?
Yes.
Is 5 times 0 faster than nothing? Okay? Unlikely that doing one multiplication is faster than doing nothing at all. Unlikely. Depends on what our definition of nothing at all is. Okay? But this is part of the idea. Let's look at some more. Can we give an example of where these two equations do the same thing? Who can give me an example? Yeah?
X and Y is 32.
Oh, okay. So, all right. 1.41, 4, etc. All right. Good. All right. So I have the square root of that times itself plus that times itself. What does that equal?
Yeah.
2. All right. And then I have that times the square root, the square root of 1 plus that divided by that times that divided by that, which equals
2.
Mess. I should have asked for a different person's example instead. But that's all right, right? This is an example. It should work for this example. If the thing is generally true. What is a counterexample? Yes?
When x equals 0.
And what should y be?
Anything
else. Okay. So you're saying I should say that 0 times 0 plus y times y, and then I have 0 times the square root of 1 plus y over 0 times y over 0. Nope, I didn't spell square root correctly. Sorry about that. All right, the first one equals?
Y.
Not always. It is the absolute value of y. Whoa. All right, what does the second one equal?
Zero.
Error. You tried to divide by 0. That isn't allowed. Okay. And so it turns out that the absolute value of y and error aren't the same, so we have a counterexample. The process of finding examples and counterexamples is important. It is very tempting, particularly when you're a student and you trust the instructor, to skip trying to write examples and seeing if things are true. This is a bad temptation. Don't do it. Write the examples. We will often ask you to prove things in class. It is worth your while verifying that it is true before you try to prove it. Try a few examples, okay? This will help you understand not only that it's true, but also why it's true. The process of working through the example will give you a deeper intuition of the thing being claimed. Questions about the idea of producing examples and counterexamples? Yes?
Can you add in a closed parameter in the error?
I could.
Really, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Please.
All right. Anything else? Yeah. I can. I have the ability to add and remove. Look at the magic of my power. All right. Item 3, being wrong often and admitting it. I have a quote from Kuhn, then also from another person, which we'll mention in a moment. Mathematicians, regardless of who is actually right, are not only willing to accept they're wrong, but eager enough to radically switch sides when they see a potential flaw in their argument. Or as one of my teachers when I was an undergraduate said, mathematicians leave their ego at home. Hey? Being wrong is a key thing. Before we dive into my exercise, thoughts, comments, questions about this idea? I know I mentioned a little bit last time as well. Okay. I don't know if we want to spend the time on this exercise. Maybe we'll consider this as homework that I'm not going to follow up on. Pick a claim, find somebody else, and argue until one of you gets stuck, and then switch sides. Okay? I have done this with dozens of mathematically minded people. It is a common thing to do. It is not very common outside of that. If you feel really brave, you might actually try something you care passionately about. Okay? It is a useful exercise to get in the habit of trying to strengthen your enemy's argument. Because if you can get past your emotions and think about how strong an argument could they make, you'll start to think more about the argument itself, the mathematics of it, compared to your emotional reaction to it. And so I would encourage you to do this. We're not going to spend time in class doing it right now, but this is actually something I really, truly do recommend you do. Find somebody, pick a topic, argue, switch sides. Ideally, do that several times. Maybe take several days doing it. Maybe take the rest of the semester and the rest of your life doing it. This actually happens. This is how we come to deeper understandings of ideas. And is a useful process in understanding truth, if there is a truth, but understanding the nuances of opinion if it's a matter of opinion. Evaluating the many possible consequences of a claim. Two quotes from Kuhn. Exploring limits of a claim, oh, I have two things, is can. We'll make that illusion larger. Exploring limits of a claim can also be used as a litmus test for deciding which arguments are worthwhile to understand in detail. Also, often, you simply realize you were wrong. This habit is less a formal variation of being wrong often and coming up with counterexamples. So, the consequences of a claim. Thoughts, comments, questions before we dive in a little bit more. Kuhn gives a worthwhile to look at a little bit longer. Where do I have this? Discussing definitions, counterexamples. He quotes from Scott Aronson's thing about the JFK assassination conspiracy theorists, which is long enough ago, probably most of you don't have emotional attachment to it. But it turns out that there are these, that he sort of goes through it and he gives a list of consequences. Okay? The idea being, if a group of people conspired to experience this trying to kill a sitting US president, then what? What would follow if they were able to organize in a way to do that? And some of the things he claims, and you can argue whether these are actual consequences or not, is that if the conspiracy, let's look at number 12 here. If a conspiracy could successfully assassinate a sitting US president, what would they do afterwards? If you've got enough organization to get past the Secret Service, what would you do next? Like, why would we assume it would vanish, right? These are the kinds of ideas of how you find you're wrong, right? You say, I believe that my solution to this problem is the best in the world. If that was really true, what would follow? And often that thought process can help you. There's also a much more mathematical version of this we can do. But here's a claim I saw noted in an exercise, a 22-year-long exercise, to write a non-trivial piece of code and prove that it was correct. They claimed that proving code correct takes 10 times longer than writing the code itself. Turn to saying next to, what are some consequences of this claim if it is true? What would follow from this claim? Something that would be true if this claim was true. Yes?
It assumes that all code to be proven correct in a finite amount of time.
Okay, so that's an assumption rather than a consequence, but let me talk about that. I see. No, this is a consequence. Does this mean that all code can be proven correct? Does it actually assume that, does it result that all code can be proven correct? Let's think about the definition of all. Maybe it means all correct code can be proven correct. Hey, I think this is, you could argue about it both ways, right? But this is a suggestion. I would make a little clarification in the definition there. But this is a consequence. Give me another one. Yes? How do I say that? Empty code is correct
with no effort is proven correct. How about that? If I spent no time writing the code, it should take me no time to prove it's correct. Okay? What else? Yeah?
Maybe the focus on teaching new programmers should be like 10 times more on proving of the correct code rather than teaching and actually writing it.
Okay? Why? Okay. Yeah.
Given that proving the code takes so much longer than writing the code, many programmers might not put in the effort to prove their code correct.
Seems likely. Yeah. Let's think about these claims. Are any of them false consequences? Are any of them things that are not true, and therefore we can say the claim must be false? Is it true that all correct code can be proven correct? This is a really, really hard question to answer. A really, really hard question to answer. Barely poke at it when you take CS3102, computational theory. Barely poke at it. Just the surface level ideas. This is a really hard question to answer. I can't tell you the answer. I can tell you pieces of the answer, but I don't want to spend that much time. Is empty code trivially correct? Or trivially incorrect? Can I prove empty code in no time at all? Yeah, I think so. Right? Should we spend 10 hours teaching proofs for every hour we spend coding? There's another assumption underlying this, which is that we should prove code correct. If we should prove code correct, and if the learning also takes 10 times as long, then this would follow. Does that? There are differences of opinion on both points. Should I try to minimize my coding time so I have time to prove it?
Yes.
I think I should probably minimize my coding time for other reasons. I should minimize my coding time because I love to sleep, right? There's lots of reasons to minimize your coding time. But it isn't obviously violated. Do programmers prove their code correct? Almost never. Almost never. The more than 10 lines of code accompanied with a proof of correctness that I am aware of, I can count on one hand. Okay? There are certainly those that I'm not aware of, but it is very unusual to have any non-trivial code accompanied with a proof of correctness. So we can start thinking about the consequences of the claim. Okay? As we start understanding it, then we can start thinking, and sometimes the consequences will also suggest new ideas. Okay? If we decide that code should be proven correct, then some of these consequences suggest that maybe we should try to change the truth of this claim. Can we make it faster to prove code? We can get a new goal out of understanding what results from what. Okay? It turns out there are things we could put as a consequence here that will show this claim is false. Okay? Random code is easier to prove. If I generate code by just randomly typing things and then having some sort of intelligent syntax checker force it into valid code, shouldn't that be really easy to prove? Because I can write that in like milliseconds for thousands of lines of code. So I should be able to prove it in tens of milliseconds. Hooray! So I should just randomly generate code with proofs, and away we go. But it doesn't work, right? So there's some other assumptions underlying this statement, which leads us on to our next point. Teasing apart the assumptions underlying the claim. Again from Kuhn, when someone makes a claim in mathematics out loud, they're usually phrasing it in a way they hope will convey the core idea to another human as easily as possible.
That usually means they're using words in ways one might not expect. Okay? We tend to use words in specialized contexts, not the way they initially seem. Let's try to understand the assumptions underlying the words being used is a key mathematical ability. Here I have two claims. Java is the best language for teaching CS2110, and UVA graduates get better jobs than those who do not go to school. Okay, take a few minutes. Identify some assumptions in these claims. Again, chat with your neighbors, unless you don't like your neighbors. Assumptions. Yes. Yeah.
That for the first one, assuming that there's like an objective set of like, you know, conditions you can use to say that time of day is better than time of B.
Okay. Assumes I can tell what is best. Yeah.
Java is a language.
I agree. That is assumed in this statement. Yes.
Assume that you need to be taught a programming language in CS2110.
Okay. Others for this first one?
There's a class called CS2.
Yeah?
Language is not referring to spoken language, it's a code.
Huh. Now let's just pause and think about what it would be if we meant the other.
Can you imagine what 2110 be like if the teacher spoke Java?
All right. Right, every class would begin public clash lecture 3, public static void mainstream bracket bracket arcs, right? Anyway, all right, so some assumptions here. Okay, let's look at this second one. What are some assumptions here? Yeah.
Better means high paying or higher paying.
Yeah.
There are jobs available.
Yeah.
People get jobs.
Why do you say that?
Because that would mean, like, it was not on average that all UVA graduates would get better jobs if people don't go to school, and that may not be true.
Yeah. This is an interesting one. This sentence could have meant the UVA graduate with the worst job has a better job than the non-graduate with the best job. That is a logically consistent reading of this English, right? All of the UVA graduates are above any of the non-UVA graduates. But probably none of you originally assumed that's what this meant, right? There is an assumption baked into just the wording of the phrase. And if somebody asks you, why do you think that's what they mean? Because humans? I don't know. It just is how we use words, probably. I guess I don't know. Maybe they meant the other. And that's a challenge with these, right? We don't actually know that better means more money either. Maybe better means more fun. Maybe we have defined the objective function of goodness of job as the number of UVA graduates working in it, because everybody wants to work with grads, right? Right? There's lots of ways we could have defined better. So we have these assumptions, and likely, when he said better is more money, you're like, oh yeah, yeah. Maybe a few of you are like, no. Right? But these assumptions tend to be so baked in that until you identify them, it's hard to think about whether they're true or not, right? The very idea that there are best languages is a weird assumption. The idea that you can compare languages is an odd assumption. And maybe it's justified, and maybe it's not. But until we identify what those assumptions are, it's hard to evaluate the truth of the claim. If you want to get down a rabbit hole of unspoken assumptions, listen to any political candidate. Okay? They will make sentences that would take you days to identify all of the assumptions on a regular basis. And there is a reason for that, and if it's a political science class, we might talk to you about all that sorts of things, but it's not, so we won't. All right. But understanding the assumptions is important if we're going to make mathematical progress. Because without them, we don't know what people are actually saying. All right, last one, scaling the ladder of abstraction. Kuhn states, mathematicians regularly scale this ladder. He describes how the ladder, in some degree that I won't go into right now, right? Particularly in the later stages of graduate school. I picked this quote because this really is something that will matter more longer in the future. We're going to spend relatively little time on this sixth skill in this class. It's going to come back a lot. This is a major topic of CS2150, although it's not usually identified as such. But a major goal of 2150 is to get used to a particular abstraction ladder. But let's take some examples that actually just came from last semester in this class. Here I have two statements. All monkeys are in love. And for every monkey P, there exists another monkey Q, such that P is not the same as Q, and P loves Q, and Q loves P. Which one is more abstract? Yeah.
The first.
The first. Why do you say the first?
Because it has less specific terminology.
Less specific terminology. Okay, does anyone argue for the second being more abstract? We have taught you well. In usual English context, abstract does not mean what it means for mathematicians and computer scientists. Okay? In regular English context, it would be common to say this is an abstract sentence because it has all of these sort of vague, undefined ideas, all these extra variables, what do you mean by he and q, blah. So, but in math, this is less abstract because more things are defined. Turn to whoever you're sitting next to and argue either that these two sentences are or are not equivalent. Relationship and you realize you want to say they're not my equal, you should find somebody else. And on that note, I will see you all on Friday.